It is a pleasure for me to be here and to have this opportunity to address Tycon today. I think your kind applause for Arun drowned out the topic that he has saddled me with, which is disruption and convergence, tolerance, terrorism, and the global imagination. Now, what does that mean? Well, in thinking about our topic for today, I found myself thinking about both the lives that Arun mentioned in introducing me. The issues that have dominated my UN life of late, the forces of globalization irresistibly transforming the world, the information technology revolution that brings to our breakfast tables and our living rooms, and increasingly to our computers and our mobile phones, snippets of information and glimpses of events from every corner of the globe. These are, of course, the forces of convergence that have made the world one village, one market, one audience. And then I also thought about the changes that terrorism has wrought in us and in our imaginations, the rise in violent manifestations of intolerance, and of course, the troubles in Iraq and Sudan and elsewhere. These are the forces of disruption that threaten in many ways to create new divisions between the haves and the have-nots, between North and South, between people of different creeds and cultures and religions. These two groups of phenomena are clearly pulling us together as they drive us apart. But on September 11, 2001, in the United States, a different challenge arose to the notion of a global imagination. If, as the historian Eric Hobsbawm has suggested, the 20th century really began with the assassination in Sarajevo that sparked the First World War, it's fair to suggest that in the impact it has already had on the shape of our era, the 21st century began with the demolition of the World Trade Center just over 3 years ago. I suspect, therefore, that on 9/11, the 21st century was born. What do I mean by that? The destruction of the World Trade Center, after all, seemed at the time to strike a blow not only at the institutions of American and global capitalism, but at the self-confidence that undergirded them. The self-confidence of a social and political system and an economic system that, without needing to think about it too much, believed it had found the answer to life's challenges and could conquer them all. And of course, the outrage of September 11 brought the stark consciousness of physical vulnerability to the most powerful country in the world, a country that, despite fighting a dozen major wars in its history, had not seen a direct attack on a major city in living memory. Now, the US, as you all know, enjoys a comparative military power that's at a level unprecedented in human history. Even the Roman Empire at its peak did not come close to outstripping the military capacities of the rest of the world to the extent that the United States does today. But that is not all. When the former French foreign minister, Hubert Védrine, called the US a hyperpower, hyperpuissance, he was alluding not only to American military dominance, but also to the US as the home of Boeing and Intel, Microsoft and MTV, of Hollywood and Disneyland, of McDonald's and Starbucks, in short, of most of the major brands that dominate daily life around our globe. This was, after all, the country in which a scholar could complacently propound the end of history. On 9/11, history, like Mark Twain, proclaimed that reports of its demise were somewhat exaggerated. In today's ever smaller world, geography too offered no protection. If only by bringing home to Americans the end of their insulation from the passions that have bedeviled the rest of the globe, September 11th changed the world forever. And the horrifying events of that one day are also emblematic of our new century. The defining features of today's world, the forces of convergence that your conference is here to discuss, are the relentless forces of globalization, the ease of communications and travel, the shrinking of boundaries, the flow of people of all nationalities and colors across the globe, the swift pulsing of financial transactions with the press of a button. The aeroplane, the mobile phone, the computer are the tools of our time. These very forces, which in a more benign moment might have been seen as helping drive the world towards progress and prosperity and indeed convergence, were the very forces used by the terrorists on 9/11 in their macabre dance of death and destruction. These forces of convergence became the forces of disruption. The terrorists crossed frontiers easily, coordinated their efforts with technological precision, hijacked jets and crashed them into their targets as their doomed victims made last-minute calls on their cell phones to their loved ones. This was a 21st century crime, and it has defined the dangers and the potential of our time as nothing else can. And 9/11 made clear the old cliche about our global village, for it showed that a fire that starts in a remote thatched hut or dusty tent in one corner of our global village can melt the steel girders of the tallest skyscrapers at the other end of the global village. And the terrorist strikes, not just of 9/11, but its horrible descendants in London and Madrid and Bali and Delhi, were assaults not just on one country, but in their callous indifference to the lives of innocents from dozens of countries around the world, it was an assault on the very bonds of humanity that tie us all together. To respond to these attacks, we must be united. Terrorism does not originate in any one country. Its practitioners are not based in any one country. Its victims are not found in one country. And so the response to it must also involve all countries. Governments and people around the world are slowly coming to understand this. One of the less widely reported outcomes of the great gathering of world leaders at the UN last September, the largest single gathering of heads of state and government in human history at any one time on the planet, was a commitment, the first time, a condemnation by all governments of terrorism in all its forms and manifestations, and I'm quoting here, committed by whomever, wherever, and for whatever purposes. There are still those in our world who would seek to excuse terror, to find extenuation in the wrongs the terrorists claim to be seeking to redress. With this unambiguous declaration by every country on earth, we now have moral clarity, and legal clarity should follow if the pressure, led by India as it happens, for a comprehensive convention against terrorism can be sustained. But the fact is that to cure the world of the blight of terrorism, it is not enough to successfully prosecute or chase down perpetrators. We have to also cut off the sources of sustenance for terrorism. And there, I think we have to stretch our imaginations, because in one sense, the terrorists of 9/11 and after are attacking the globalization of the human imagination. In an issue of Red Herring in 2002, a magazine that I understand many of you read or read quite regularly in Silicon Valley, Jason Ponting wrote, and I quote, that the Western culture that the developing world associated with globalization, secular, materialist, pluralistic, and promiscuous, was spectacularly rejected by the attacks on the World Trade Center. And he went on to quote the historian Felipe Fernandez Ernesto as saying that those who cheered the attacks were declining modernity. Now, I think that's perhaps something a little sweeping, even simplistic about that point. But I must admit that those who professed around the world to understand these attacks were those who saw themselves as rejecting a globalization from which they were or felt excluded. We all know that terrorism emerges from blind hatred of another, other with a capital O. And that, in turn, is the product of three factors: fear, rage, and incomprehension. Fear of what the other might do to you, rage at what you believe the other has done to you, and incomprehension about who or what the other really is. These three elements fuse together in igniting the deadly combustion that kills and destroys people whose only sin, very often, is that they feel none of these things themselves. If terrorism is to be tackled and ended, we will have to deal with each of these factors by attacking the ignorance that sustains them. We will have to know each other better, learn to see ourselves as others see us, learn to recognize hatred and deal with its causes, learn to dispel fear, and above all, just learn about each other. That's why I'm so pleased to see the word learn so high on your motto for this conference. But this is no small challenge. You know, with the best will in the world, it's easy to misunderstand each other. Since so many of us in this hall are Indians living in America, I think I should share with you, even though I fear it may be too early in the conference to risk this, my favorite story of international misunderstanding. Is when I see words like network and partnership, I think of previous attempts to ensure networking and partnership. And I think the story of the American agricultural expert who was sent to India before the Green Revolution to advise on Indian farming. So this fellow who's from, you know, big agricultural community in Kansas or somewhere, goes to the Punjab and visits this tiny little farm where he's welcomed by the hospitable and gregarious Sikh farmer. He says very proudly to the American, "Welcome to my farm." Now, it's not bigger than the size of this auditorium in the convention center. But he's very proud of it. He says, "You know, my land goes all the way up to there." He says, "You see that national highway?" And the American looks and he sees a dirt road. And the farmer says, "My land goes up to there." And he says, "You see that irrigation canal?" And the American looks and sees a trickle of water. And he says, "My land goes all the way up to there." And then he says to the American, "And what about you?" Well, the American, as I said, is from one of these, you know, rippling, rolling prairie wheat field backgrounds, you know, some gigantic farm in Kansas or whatever. So he clears his throat and says, "Well, in the morning I get into my tractor and I drive 4 hours south to the southern boundary of my farm. And then it's 3 hours west on my tractor to the western boundary of my farm. Then I break for a sandwich and I get back into my tractor. It's another 2.5 hours north to the northern boundary of my farm. And then at sundown, it's another couple of hours on my tractor back to the ranch house." And he finds a Sikh farmer nodding very sympathetically. I know," says the Indian. "I too used to have a tractor like that." But the point of the story, other than, of course, to stir you up for the morning session, is to make a very simple point, which is that what you understand depends on what your assumptions are. We need to ask what factors and what assumptions lead surprisingly large numbers of young people around the world to follow or to endorse or to applaud the desperate course set by fanatics and ideologues. You know, 40 years ago, 44 years ago, in 1962, the now all but forgotten UN Secretary General U Thant warned that an explosion of violence could occur as a result of the sense of injustice felt by those living in poverty and despair in a world of plenty. You know, some 2,600 people died in the World Trade Center on 9/11. But some 26,000 people also died on 9/11 around the world, except they died from starvation, from unclean drinking water, from preventable disease. We cannot afford to exclude them from our global imaginations. We cannot forget them as we celebrate convergence. And that, of course, is not all. Because when we look at that word "learn" up there on your motto, if a state cannot even offer its people hope for a better life for their children by providing them basic education, then how can we expect those people or those children to resist the blandishments of terror? It should come as no surprise that the Taliban, for example, recruited its foot soldiers from the religious schools or madrasas that were the only source of nurture and education for the many children who had no other source of knowledge available to them, who learned not science or mathematics or computer programming at these schools, but rather only the creed of the Quran and the Kalashnikov, the Quran crudely interpreted, the Kalashnikov crudely made. In a world where groups and even nations have little or no hope of reaping the benefits of globalization, who can be surprised that they view it as something to be derided and even attacked? So as we celebrate convergence, let us also converge together to ensure that all people have access to, at a minimum, the opportunity to live beyond starvation, to receive an education, and to have realistic hopes for a better future. And eliminating dire poverty will not in itself solve our problems in this age of terror. A sense of oppression, of exclusion, of marginalization can also give rise to extremism.